respect to, you remember, by dA, I mean the derivative respect to x component a, okay? And so I had dA of alpha of x, and then this functional derivative, which we had briefly discussed, psi on a equals 0. And in fact, in writing it like this, I should be more precise. And what I'm still lacking is an integration over dx that, if you go back to the way we introduced this functional derivative, should be rather intuitive, because if you think about just this ordinary derivative here, then you know that in the chain rule you would be using, let's say, let me. So when you have a function of many variables, you would write a differential, a sum over di of the gradient times these differentials like this. So and in the example that we used, remember the example was, if I have a function of two variables which I want it to be invariant under translation in a certain direction lambda, then what I'm gonna impose is that this equation is equal to zero, where here I have a sum over di, okay? This is a scalar product. In our context, in which you think of these functional derivatives as a generalization of a system with many coordinates which are in a sense infinity, which are densely continuous, that's maybe easier to say, then this summation over di will become an integral over dx. And then I will have, let's say, lambda of x, and then some functional derivative like in our case. And here the function will be a function of a of the variable, okay? So actually, to properly write this equation, I should have used right from the beginning, but I think I didn't, the integral over dx. You have to think of this integral over dx as doing the same job that the sum is doing there, namely to make sense of this expression as a scalar product. Okay, so this concludes in a more precise way this analogy with a finite dimensional case. So we said that we have to impose this condition in order to be sure that the state is physical, namely the states describe physical properties of the electromagnetic field. And I promised you at the end of the class to relate this property to the Gauss law for the electromagnetic field. And this can be done as follows, because I already told you how the canonical structure for the electromagnetic field sees what I've been calling already connection, but you know as the vector potential, and then the electric field. And the canonical structure is that we have a Dirac delta in here, okay? And so when you try to do the canonical quantization by putting hats onto the variables and turns in the Poisson brackets into commutators, you are gonna seek for a representation of operators such that this algebra is represented. So we have I h bar, b a, and this algebra here looks very much similar to the ordinary case of ordinary quantum mechanics, in which we started on, let's say, in three-dimensional space, so the analogy is more persistent, in which we seek for operators that satisfy this algebra here. And we know that there's a solution to this problem, which is called the Schrödinger representation, in which Qi acts as a multiplication, and Pi acts as the derivative with respect of Qi, and you're working on an Hilbert space in which the wave functions are wave functions of the Qi, okay? So a similar thing can be done in here, in which you realize the operator A as a multiplication operator, the operator E as a differential, as a functional derivative operator, And you work on a Hilbert space which is made of functions of the vector potential, or I should more properly say functionals, because these are functions of functions. Okay, so that's the name for these quantities. And this is the canonical system. As you know, when you study the electromagnetic field in the way you've already done in your classes, you know that there is one of the Maxwell's equations, which using my notation, I will just write dA, so this divergence has to be equal to zero if there are no sources, okay? I'm just considering pure electromagnetic field with no sources. So this has to be equal to zero, which is the Gauss law. So what happens at the quantum level? And you remember, you have to think of this now in a precise analogy with our initial timeless double pendulum system, in which you remember I said that instead of having A, B, T, and an Hamiltonian that gives you the equations of motion, we had a different, sorry, and a real Hamiltonian, which was giving the equations of motions, we had only A and T, A and B, and then a super Hamiltonian or Hamiltonian constraint, which wasn't interpreted as the energy, but as a function that was constraining one of these variables to be a function of the other here. And then at the quantum level, we were interested in turning these into an operator. And Dirac procedure told us that the way we have to interpret this is a restriction on the possible wave functions admitted. So I'm just trying to repeat the same thing for electromagnetism. We already know the answer. These are the wave functions that are they should be physically emitted because they should not depend on choices of gauge, the physical states. And now I'm going to show you that that is exactly a realization of implementing a constraint at the quantum level, and the constraint is the Gauss law. And this can be seen because here, let us go back to this expression. So this left-hand side now, if you want, this is precisely the Schrödinger picture for the operator E. So here I can write this as the integral over dx of dA alpha of x, and then the operator E A of x acting on psi of A. And then I can integrate by parts. And by integrating by parts, I pick up a minus sign. And then the integral, sorry, these are all the cube x, of course. And I pick alpha of x, and then now the derivative dA is acting precisely on the operator E of x, and then psi of A. So imposing that this quantity here is equal to zero is a regularized, because there is this integration, way of imposing precisely this classical equation at the quantum level, namely dA as an operator acting on psi of A equal to zero, Dirac's procedure, okay? So imposing this constraint at the quantum level, really what it means is to require the wave function to be invariant under gauge transformations. Okay, so once you have done this, electromagnetism is not like general relativity, so once you're done this, you have now, you started from the initial Hilbert space, let's say H zero, the initial Hilbert space where you had your functionals of A. And now you have imposed this constraint. Let me, for brevity, let me call it just G, the Gauss constraint. So you have imposed this constraint and you're down to those states. Let me call them psi physical of A, which satisfy the property that they are invariant under gauge transformations. And these states here live in a subspace, which I'm going to call H phis. Okay? Once you are in this subspace, then you have a real Hamiltonian, which is just the ordinary Hamiltonian for electromagnetism, so B squared plus E squared, And then you can do your quantum theory in terms of the usual Hamiltonian, just working in this subspace. So the problem of solving constraints is finished, okay? So I've introduced the electromagnetic case because it gave us the technical tools in order to deal with this problem of imposing constraints at the quantum level. But the situation does not require dealing also with the conceptual problems that we have in quantum gravity, because once this constraint is imposed, all we have is a normal quantum mechanical system with a real Hamiltonian. Whereas, as I've already told you, in general relativity, we have this problem of the zero Hamiltonian. So before going back to general relativity, I need to point out three aspects of this electromagnetic case, which are going to be useful to deal with the with general relativity. First of all, one nice thing that one can do is counting the degrees of freedom of this field. You can see that you start from, I think that you, in your class in electromagnetics, you only started from the three-dimensional vector potential. So I'll start simply directly from there. And then we have imposed a condition, the Gauss law. And you can see that this condition as telling you that out of the three components of this vector potential, only two components are truly physical. So that are typically called the transverse components. So you can use the constraints present in your system to compute and to understand what are really the physical components, the physical degrees of freedom of the field you're working on. Another, a little bit more involved aspect of this that we are going to need is what is now the explicit form of the states that live in this Hilbert space. What are these functions here? For the moment, I've only told you what their property is, their properties to be invariant under gauge transformation. But can I be more explicit and see what they look like? What is their face? So to do so, I have already introduced the line integral. So you pick up a curve, gamma, and I've already introduced the line integral as the, in a certain, you choose a parameterization of this curve, and then you can write this as in the following way, where gamma A of S is the parameterization of this curve. Here, let me be a little bit more technical. In principle, the vector potential is a function of, is three functions, because it's a vector, of the three components of space. So let me write this line integral in a mathematically more precise way by using a delta that imposes each of these x components to be to lie on the parameterization of the curve. Okay, this is a more precise mathematical definition of this line integral. This delta tells me that of the vector potential, what I'm really interested in is just when it is along the line. And this part here tells me that I'm only interested in its component as a vector along the tangent to the line. Okay, so what happens if I now make one of those gauge transformations, namely in which A goes into A plus the derivative of some scalar with respect to XA, that this line integral goes into itself plus what do I have now is the integral between 0 and 1 in ds of d alpha over dxa times d gamma a over ds times this delta that tells me that I have to lie with my scalar function alpha, I have to lie on the curve parameterized by s. Okay, but now it is easy to be convinced that let me write these in a more suggestive way by saying that that the differential of alpha as a function of x can be written as d alpha over dxa times the dxa, okay? So this part here, this parametrization, truly what it means is that I'm expressing gamma as x1 of s, x2 of s, x3 of s, right? You're familiar with parametrizing curves in space. So this quantity here is just the alpha over the s. So this integral, precisely because I have this delta here that tells me that I can identify x with the parametrization of gamma. So this extra piece, I'm gonna need to erase this. So this extra piece here gives rise to just a total variation. So we have the integral, the line integral of A plus the integral of the alpha from the initial to the final point. So let me keep still the affine coordinate S I'm using. So you see that if now this color field alpha could be arbitrary. So in principle here, the value at this point, let's say the point A is gonna be different from the value of alpha at this point here, the point B. However, if I now consider the special case in which the line is closed, namely forms a loop, then this extra piece here is identically zero. Okay, so you see that in order, I'm trying to construct these states here, okay? So states that explicitly have this property. And I've shown you how, maybe I will keep this one and use this one. And I'll show you here how the line integral of the connection or vector potential has this property if gamma is a loop. Typically, sometimes you might find this notation here. It's a circular integral to remind you that the loop we are looking at is that the line you're looking at is a loop, namely it's closed. Oh, and a small step, but it is useful to take, is to realize that now this is just a number. You assign it a particular vector potential. This is a number, so in principle you can take the exponential of this quantity here. Okay, the exponential of this quantity here is called, let me call it W of A, because if I change the value of A, and it also depends on gamma, and this one is called a Wilson line. This functional here of the connection and of the loop gamma, well, a Wilson loop, in fact, because I'm looking at a loop. So the collection of the states of this sort live in this Hilbert space. What does it mean, the collection of the states of this sort? What are the variables in these states here? Both A and gamma. Namely, I choose a different gamma, I have a different state, still in the same Hilbert space. I choose a different configuration of the connection A, I get a different state that lives in this Hilbert space here. Or better, A, I can see it as a choice of the best way to look at this is to imagine when you're doing the harmonic oscillator, and let's say you're looking at eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So you know those states will be labeled by an integer. And yet for these states you can choose what is the basis in which you decide to project them to have an explicit weight function representation. For instance, you can choose to represent them in the x variable and give these representation as wave function. The way you should think about this operator, this state here, is precisely in analogy with this formulation here, as a particular state gamma expressed in the configurations given by the vector potential, okay? So consider this analogy, this harmonic oscillator, and this would be electromagnetism. Well, this would be the gauge invariant Hilbert space of electromagnetism. Okay, before going to back to GR, there's a final comment that is going to be rather important, but I hope not entirely new to you. And this final comment is going to bring us into a discussion of Lie groups, of non-abelian Lie groups, and in particular of SU2, which you probably have seen already in your class of on quantum mechanics when you dealt with the addition of angular momenta, or even before when you just dealt with angular momenta at the quantum mechanical level. Anyway, I'll try to introduce it from scratch. And so we have seen that this Wilson line, we've seen it because, okay, so the third step I want to do is non-abelian connections. So for this electromagnetic case, we have seen that a role for the connection was to give us a sense of the physics felt by a charged particle described as a scalar field when moving along this path gamma embedded in some electromagnetic field described by the vector potential. And this is an equation that you shouldn't take as a real equality, but just to give you an idea of what is the role played by this connection and why is it called a connection. However, suppose that now, instead of being interested in describing a charged particle, which is simply a scalar field, suppose that you were dealing with some physical systems which can be identified as a vector. So it's not just a scalar field in the sense that is only determined by one number at each space point, but is determined by a vector at each space point. Now, if this field is embedded in some force field, you might expect that while traveling along this force field, is not just its value, its length that is going to change, but in principle, this vector could be rotated. You might expect that a force acting on a vector field might have the property that not just changes value, but also rotates it. In which case, you might expect, and suppose I'm calling this vector VI, let's say, and so you might expect the equivalent of this connection, where now this is describing this new force that is affecting these vectors. Now, because it can rotate in general the vector, this should become something with two indices. Namely, this should become a matrix, okay? So this is just a number, the line integral of the electromagnetic connection, but you can envisage a situation in which you have a more generic force whose connection is a matrix because it has the property of rotating also vector fields. Oh, and maybe I should use and maybe for consistency with what I'm doing later, it'd be, well, I don't know. I'll keep this notation, and if it's if any confusion is arising, we can clarify it. So in particular, the choice that I'm going to look at is, and so let's see this as a matrix equation here. So you have a certain matrix G acting on V, and of course this matrix will depend on a number of things. It will depend on X, Y, and the path chosen gamma, and then is a matrix, as we said. I'm going to consider the particular case where these matrices satisfy the property that, so this is prime, so they satisfy the property that they preserve the length of these vectors, namely the quantity VI, VI, which I can call V squared, the squared modulus, is preserved by this rotation. So this should be equal to vri prime square, which is g I j v j times g I k v k. I want this to be equal to v squared, which is v I v I, which implies that g I j g I k, where these, there are summations over the I implicit in here, this should be equal to delta j k, so that I'm reproducing this expression here. The matrices which satisfy this property, and let's take for simplicity a situation in which these are just two-dimensional vectors, so these indices are just two-dimensional. The matrix which satisfy this property are form a group. A group means that there's a product structure with an inverse and a unit, and the group defined by this matrix is called SU2, because this matrix is, well, it's not really relevant for us why it's called like this, and I don't want to depart too much from trying to get to gravity at some point. So, but what is important to tell you is that this group SU2, the matrices that satisfy this property, can be parametrized by being written as exponential of some parameter, let me call it alpha, three parameters, in fact. So this is just a set of three parameters that map all the possible matrices that satisfy the property. And then some what are called the generators, which tell me about the multiplicative structure of this group here. And I hope that you have really already seen these things in your quantum mechanical course. You should have seen that for SU2, these generators here satisfy the following algebra. So these generators as operators do not commute with themselves. Yes. So, so this is you can think of this as the group of rotations. For instance, in classical space, if you have, if you're on a two-dimensional plane, if you take a vector and you want to rotate it by an angle alpha, you know how to do this. You take, so this vector v will have components vx and vy. And if you want to rotate it, you know that v prime as a vector is going to be given by the matrix cos alpha, sine alpha, minus sine alpha, cos alpha, acting on the initial vector. Okay? It turns out that when you vary alpha between 0 and 2 pi, all these possible matrices you can find satisfy a group structure. Namely, there is a multiplication defined between them. There's an inverse operator, which is when you take the angle minus the original one. There's an identity, which is when you take the angle to be zero. Okay? So these you can generalize it to now the case in 3D. So you add a third dimension, and now you're going to have a 3 by 3. Sorry. I should have said, and this group is called U1 or SO2. Which reminds you that these are the orthogonal transformations in 2D. Orthogonal because a rotation would preserve an orthogonal basis. If you do the same in 3D, you're going to have now a 3 by 3 matrix that is going to rotate you your initial vector. And so that group is called SO3 because it's a rotation. So again, it preserves the orthogonal basis. Or SU2. This other name has mathematical reasons behind it, which I don't think it's useful to spend time on. But there are a number of things that is worth to spend some time on. For instance, Okay, before going into that, let me say, just to conclude this situation with the connection. So if I take this matrix G to be in SU2, and I still want to interpret this matrix as the exponential of line integral of some connection. Now, this is a matrix. This exponential is also a matrix, which means that A up in here is also a matrix, okay? So this will have also matrix indices ij. If I wanna G now to belong to SU2, then this connection does not satisfy anymore the property, this rescaling property here. Remember, this was a gauge transformation in electromagnetism. If now I'm trying to do a theory in which the parallel transport is not given just by the exponential of a number, but it's given by a matrix in SU2, then the gauge properties of the connection will be more complicated, not simply this one, but the transformation property would be written here. Yes. There's a sum over these I and J's, of course, have different meanings.
Sorry. You've got two lower indices there. I'm just wondering if this would imply some because there's no index on the J.
So these I as well, nothing to do with the I in here. I apologize for that. Let's say these are alpha and beta. Alpha and beta, okay? So by this I goes from 1 to 3, and it is a prop. So here, this group, SO2, is totally parametrized by just one parameter, alpha, the group of rotations on the plane. The group of rotations in space, is parametrized by three angles, which are called the Euler's angle, okay? So to parametrize the matrix in U1 or SO2, I only need one angle. So a matrix in here, I can parametrize it as some e to the I alpha, and then is single generator. There will be only one. A matrix in here will be parametrized by three angles, the Euler's angles, and so I will need three generators. So this I now goes from 1 to 3, whereas here there was a single angle in the 2D rotations. So don't get confused between this I and the fact that this is now a matrix, because as I should be telling you very soon, the dimension of a matrix that is in this group can be different. So let me just finish this. Yes.
IJI, and you explained there's no, you've got two lower I's rather than a lower I and an upper I, which means that you really find some.
There's a sum here.
There's a sum.
Yes, sorry. Yes, yes, in here as well, sorry, yes. I have to say I was expecting to be rather sketchy and quick on this part because I was assuming that maybe you had already seen these things in your quantum mechanical course, but it seems like this is not the case, which is a bit of a problem for me. I suggest that the best thing is that I try to be, instead of just sketchy, I try to be a little bit more precise and give you a series of definitions let's see, I had some notes on this, so here. Okay. So I already said that a group has a multiplication rule, an identity element, and an inverse element. This multiplication is the defining property of the group. And so, for instance, the real number with the addition form a group, because or even with the normal multiplication, so the real numbers with the usual dot multiplication, this is a group structure, because you can take the product of two real numbers x and y, and this is still a real number. Further, you have an identity element, which is the unity, one. You take any number, you multiply it by one, you still get the same number. In this sense, it's an identity element. And you have the inverse element. You take any number, you multiply it by its reciprocal number, and you get the identity, okay? So the real number with the usual product is a group structure. However, in mathematics, there's more interesting group structures. For instance, row by column multiplication rule of matrices, if you require some restrictions on the matrices you're working with, also satisfies a group structure. And so, for instance, for the case of matrices, let's say two matrices G1 and G2 belonging to SU2, this is a group, which means that the product of G1, G2 is still an element of SU2. There is an identity, so there is an element which gives you the same group, and there is an inverse element, G1 minus 1, which gives you the identity. The identity, you can think of it as the identity matrix, so just a matrix with 1 along the diagonals and zeros any other place. And what you need to specify in order to characterize the group is this multiplication rule. Then for a special class of groups called the Lie groups, these are continuous groups. It means that their elements are labeled by continuous parameters, just as the real numbers, these numbers here are real. In here as well, you can imagine that G1 is an element from a set that is continuous. When this happens, the Lie is called the Lie group. SU2 is a particular case of a Lie group. And in that case, it is convenient to parameterize these group elements in the way I've given you before, namely as the exponentials of the scalar product between the parameters, the continuous parameters. They might be in some intervals, they might belong to some intervals of the real numbers, for instance, times some matrices called the generators of the Lie group. If you do this, then this is exponential of a matrix, and this product here can be encoded in the commutator of these operators here, as I was telling you before, for SU2, but telling you uselessly because you've never seen this expression, right? You were telling me, you've never seen this expression. You should think of J as the angular momentum. Maybe then let me take that path. Let's go back to quantum mechanics for a second. You know that X, I, P, J satisfy I h bar delta I j. This is a delta. And now you can ask yourself, what is the operator that corresponds to the angular momentum? You know, L, or let's call it J, so it's already like in there. You know, I can define the vector J given by the position of a particle, external product with its momentum, right? Remember classical mechanics, this is the angular momentum of the particle. However, if now, let me call this Q. If now Q and P are operators, this is gonna be turned into an operator as well. In fact, a set of three operators. And now what you should do is to consider these three operators, J1, J2, and J3, write them in terms of Q and P's, and then use the commutation relations between Q and P's, namely this one, to understand what are the commutation relations between these guys. And you will find out, using these, that the commutation relation between J1 and J2 gives you precisely J3. J1 with itself gives you precisely zero. J1 with J3 gives you minus J2, and so on. And the compact way of characterizing all these commutation relations you can write down is this formula here, where this is the completely antisymmetric tensor, which is one for the indices taking value 1, 2, and 3, and cyclic permutations, minus one if I flip any two indices and cyclic permutations, and zero anytime there's at least one index that is being repeated. So you see, J1, J1, the index is repeated, this object is zero, I reproduce this commutation relation. So this is just a shorthand notation for all the commutators that you can write down for the angular momentum, starting from the fact that this is now a quantum operator. And so Q and P has to satisfy the usual Heisenberg relations, okay? Now there is a number of concepts that I need to introduce, not many, but that might be new to you, unfortunately. But please then just stop me. And I was not expecting to do this, so please, if I'm not clear or I've skipped something, please stop me, interrupt me, and ask questions so that you can make sure that I'm giving you a more complete presentation. So, well, if you really want to learn about spin networks, and if you really want to know about the discretization of space-time in loop quantum gravity, I'm afraid I really have to introduce the theory of SU2. So is that okay with you? Else I would just be giving you vague concepts and rough ideas. So if you don't mind, I'll, okay, so let's take this starting point. So you can define operators J, I, where I goes from 1 to 3, which are the generators of angular momentum in quantum mechanics, okay? And I don't know if this, you might have seen it already in classical mechanics, that those are truly the infinitesimal generators of angular momentum. So namely, they make your initial vector rotate by an infinitesimal angle that is multiplying this generator here. If you want a finite rotation, then what you should be considering is the exponentiated version of this scalar product. So what I've written before, sum over I. So this gives you a finite rotation of an angle, of a three-dimensional angle alpha, which means a three-dimensional angle has three components, which you can see, so alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3. These are typically called the Euler's angles. But a simpler way to think about these three components is that if you want to make a rotation in 3D space, you have to tell me the direction around which you are rotating and the angle by which you are rotating, okay? A direction in 3D space is two numbers, because the length doesn't matter. So it's two numbers, and the angle by which you're rotating is a third number. So that's why a rotation in space requires three numbers to be parametrized, whereas a rotation on the plane only required one, that matrix cos alpha. Because there I don't have to tell you the direction in which I'm rotating. There's only one possible direction, okay? The orthogonal to that plane. So that's why there's three angles. Now, so far I've been thinking of these as a 3x3 matrix. So think of these as a 3x3 matrix that acts on vectors in 3D space. Okay? That's what I've, just as in here. This is a matrix that rotates a vector in 3D space. This matrix here satisfies a group structure, this SU2 group structure, which means that the scalar, that, sorry, that the product of two matrices like this, let me see it in here, sorry. I think this makes more logical sense. Suppose now I do another rotation on the plane. I've rotated my initial vector on the plane, my initial vector V, I've rotated it by an angle alpha. Suppose now I make another rotation by an angle beta. So I'm composing the rotation of alpha with the rotation of beta. Well, it's easy to be convinced that this amount to do a single rotation by an angle alpha plus beta. So this multiplication is just as simple as that. A rotation, another rotation, it amounts to do a single rotation of the sum of two angles. This simple property is not true anymore if you're doing rotations in 3D space. If you now do a rotation, and I wish I were good at drawing, but let's say to help myself, I'm gonna draw a sphere. So if I take a vector and I now make, let's say I decide to make a rotation around this direction of an angle alpha, or let's call it theta 1, my final vector will be pointing in this direction. If now I want to add a second rotation, and let's say now with respect to a different direction, let's say to this direction here, and I'm rotating along this direction here of an angle, let's say theta 2. My final vector is now pointing in this way. So this is the result of d theta 1. Sorry, I've done d theta 1 first on my initial vector, and then I've done d theta 2. However, if I now take the starting vector and do first a rotation of theta 2 around this direction here, I'll be moving in, the bottom line, I won't be able to do this drawing clearly enough, but the bottom line is that the result would not be the same vector, okay? I will not end up with the same vector. The composition is non-trivial. So this is different than d theta 1 acting on d theta 2, acting on my initial vector. Whereas, of course, in this case here, doing the B acting on the A first, this is now D of beta plus alpha, which is the same, okay? So in this case, rotations on the plane, the order does not matter. Rotations in space, the order does matter. From the point of view of the group structure, a group like this in which the order does not matter is called an abelian group. A group in which the order matters, it's called a non-abelian group. And to use a word that comes from quantum mechanics, when if you exchange two operators, you don't get the same thing, you say that they do not commute. So I could borrow that word from quantum mechanics and say that rotations in the plane commute with each other, rotations in space do not commute with each other. Okay, so non-abelian groups are groups that have a non-commuting structure. And in fact, but as I said, it has to be a group, which means that adding these two rotations together still has to be equivalent to a new rotation, which let me call the rotation of theta 3. Of course, these all have directions as well. Eh? So to be more precise, here I've used three angles. I could use one angle and one direction, as I was telling you, to parameterize these matrices. And here, it's going to be equivalent to another rotation because it's a group. But this other rotation is not simply given by, in some sense, the sum of the parameters in here. And the exchanged composition is going to give a new theta 3 tilde, let's say. It's a different, it's still a group element, but it's different. It's another group element. Okay, this means, this is what I mean by the fact that the multiplication is not commutative, okay? So now there is a very interesting property of these groups is that this structure, so this multiplication is encoded in those commutators here. Namely, I invite you strongly to do this exercise in which you start from you start from two different rotations. So E alpha as a vector, J as a vector, times E beta J. And now imagine that both alpha, these three vectors, and sorry, this vector here and this vector here are very, very small, those parameters, so that you can make an expansion of the exponential of the type 1 plus x. And so you can write these as 1 plus, sorry, sorry about the I. 1 plus alpha dot j times alpha plus beta dot j. Now, this is equal to 1 plus alpha i. Okay, let's say this is alpha i. Ji, when I multiply here, then 1 multiplying there is going to give me beta, let's say k, jk, these are summed over because they're scalar products, plus, and then the product of this times this one, alpha I, beta j, ji, jj. Oh, and of course, in order to keep this term, which is second order in my expansion, to be consistent, I should really put the second order here as well. Okay, beta I, beta k, ji, jk, okay? So I invite, and so here as well, you need, in order for consistency, to keep to second order. So I invite you to do this first for this product here, and then for the other product. So beta j, the scalar product, e to the alpha j, okay? And then use these commutation relations. Yes.
Oh, we lost the word. Okay. Okay, because I want you,
To realize how this non-commuting structure takes care of the fact that these two groups, group elements, do not commute. The order matters. So do this exercise. Okay, now, I need now to abstract the situation a little bit. So let me erase this. So long, we have been considering these group elements as rotations on a three-dimensional vector space. Well, it turns out that the product structure, which is non-commutative, as I said, and it is induced by these non-commutative relations here, can be applied to spaces of different dimensions than only three, okay? So the logic was, I have the generators of angular momenta ji, they satisfy this algebra, ijk, jk, and this induces for the objects which are written as e to the alpha j, the group structure of SU2. By group structure, meaning the presence of a well-defined multiplication with inverse and identity element. However, this group structure can be applied now not only to spaces of dimension three. So if you apply it to a space of dimension three, that gives you the usual rotation you have in mind. But it turns out that the same group structure can be represented in vectorial spaces of different dimensions. Okay? By this, I mean the following. Namely that any vector space V over which the group acts as endomorphisms as an endomorphism, namely that when G acts on V, sorry, namely that given some vector belonging to this vector space V, also G composed V still belongs to V. So it keeps me in the same vector space. This means yes.
They're there and they're wondering.
Like this?
I don't know how to do it.
Maybe that's no. I don't know, but maybe the guy that is supposed to monitor the situation.
Help.
We've lost wealth. Can we? Hey, there. Something up. Something's up.
No.
No.
Just
wealth is still lost. So let me go on, because else we never get out of this detour that I'm forced to take. So any vector space over which the group acts as an endomorphism is called a representation. A representation of the group, okay? In particular, vectors in three-dimensional Euclidean space are a representation of the group, because we have just introduced this group precisely as the group of rotations of three-dimensional vectors. So you take a three-dimensional vector, you rotate it, that's still a three-dimensional vector. So it, according to this definition, it is a representation. The
the vector space or the representation with the smallest dimension is called the fundamental. And now I'm gonna to describe these representations. I'm gonna use the representation of vectors as cats, okay? As in Dirac. So if I have a group element G acting on a representation V, I'm gonna choose, I'm gonna pick a basis N for the vector space V. And then I'm gonna say that I can represent the group as a matrix using these bases I've already introduced here. And so in this representation V, the group element is a matrix MN, which I can write in the bracket notation. And in fact, let me remind somewhere that I'm working in the representation V, okay? So this, I'm gonna make explicit that it depends on the representation I'm looking at. So for instance, for G belonging to SO2, so the rotations on the plane, the representation on V given by R2 of any group element, MN, is given by the matrix cos alpha sin alpha minus sin alpha cos alpha. And for G belonging to SO3, which as I told you is similar, basically is the same thing as SO2, then we have a representation on V given by the vectors in 3D space. And this is now a 3x3 matrix, which depends not on just one angle, but as we said, this depends on three angles, the Euler's angles. Okay, I'm gonna now, I've introduced almost everything I need, but there is still one more concept, and is the fact that representations can have a property which is called reducibility, and this happens every time you can write that matrix there in a special block diagonal form. So if D of some representation V of some group is of the form D1, then block of zeros, and then D2 of G for all Gs up, belonging to the group we are looking at, so SU2 in our case, then V is said reducible. Every time this does not happen, and that for a generic group element, all the places in the matrix are represented, that representation is called irreducible. What it turns out is that studying the irreducible representations of a group are enough to characterize most of its properties which are relevant for physics. And in fact, it's a big branch of mathematics that does this. And the reducible representation of SU2 in particular will turn out to be very relevant for our construction of quantum gravity. And so I should tell you what these irreducible representations are, and they're very simple. So they are just all the vector spaces of integer dimension. So in the case of SU2, the irreducible representations, which are often spelled as just irreps, are the vector spaces of integer dimension n. And it is convenient to parameterize n as 2j plus 1, where j can be an integer or an half integer. Okay? So j is equal to 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, and so on. And so when j is 0, then the dimension is just 1. When j is 1 half, the dimension is 2. When j is 1, the dimension is 3. When j is 3 half, the dimension is 4. And for the base vectors of these vector spaces, we're going to introduce a notation m, where m goes from minus j, 0, and then j. So here, j is 0, so m can only be 0. In fact, it's a single, it's a singlet space. It has only one dimension, there's only one base vector. Here, m can be minus 1 half or plus 1 half. So this is a two-dimensional vector space. Here, m can be minus 1, 0, or 1. And here it can be minus 3 half, minus 1 half, plus 1 half, and plus 1. And now you of course you haven't done the hydrogen atom, have you? You did? You know what the hydrogen atom, the quantization of the hydrogen atom, and how the levels of the electrons are specified? You remember these quantum numbers? J or L, maybe you called it. N, maybe this might give you a little bit of confusion, because I think in the hydrogen atom, N is used for the radius. Forget about that N. Just think about the angular quantum numbers, L and M. This is precisely L. And so 0 is when the orbital is a sphere. 1 half, well, in that case of the hydrogen atom, this can only take integer values, really. So you only have 0, this is a sphere. Then you have 1, which is that sort of shaped 8. You remember these things? Okay, so you have seen this representation of these vector spaces. And these are the different polarization the electron can be in for the, according to those orbitals. So, so in fact, this is a nice way of actually thinking of this group, SU2. SU2, first of all, enters the, as a group, it enters physics both classically and quantum mechanically. In fact, I mean, even classically, suppose you have a function on a sphere. So theta and phi are the two coordinates on a sphere. And now you want to, yes?
First word there, underlined?
Yeah. Irreducible representation.
Okay.
Okay? That's an important thing, because somehow, if you have a reducible representation that you can write like this direct, like this block diagonal form, then you can reconstruct its properties from the properties of each block. That's why the reducible ones are the only ones that really matter. So you know what the you know what the Fourier transform is. So if you have a function of an angle, for instance, you can write these as sums over the Fourier components and then the Fourier modes, I and theta, right? You have seen these at some point at school. And this guy here, it's related to SO2. The rotation on the plane. And what happens is that if you now have a function on a sphere, the mode decomposition has to do with SU2, the rotation in 3D. And so a function like this, you can only, you can always write it using these, the mode decomposition will now depend on the irreducible representation you're looking at and the vector space. So this is gonna be a sum over all the j's. And in fact, in classical theories, as for the harmonics, well, okay, anyway, sum over all the j's, and then the sum over the m that goes from minus j to j, and then the Fourier components, so jm, and then the modes. And the modes, which using a bracket notation, I would call like this, in a bracket notation, are called spherical harmonics. Just as these modes here are called harmonics, right? In ordinary Fourier analysis. These are spherical harmonics because they're not just on a circle, but on a sphere. So this SU2 enters, this tells you precisely this sum, when j is equal to zero, you have the sphere. So you have the spherical contribution to this function. Then at j equal one, you have the orbital like this. So it's this kind of contribution to this function. And then you remember from chemistry that the d orbitals are something like this and so on. This is called the multiple expansion in classical physics. So this was, I'm sorry for this detour, but this description of the irreducible representations was important for the following. Let us now try to go back to the physical interpretation. In classical physics, angular momentum is a vector. So you can certainly add two angular momenta as two normal vectors, okay? So you have one angular momentum, say J1. Of course, this is Q1 cross P1 of some particle, but let's forget about that. And then let's say you have another one, J2. And classically, you can certainly consider just the sum of these two angular momenta. And of course, the result will depend on the relative angle between the two. For instance, if they're opposite, the sum will just be zero. If they're opposite and their modulus is the same. When these now become quantum mechanical operators, the addition of these two operators is not anymore something straightforward. They are now operators. In particular, this addition turns out to be not even associative, which means that if you're adding a third guy here, if you choose to add these two guys and then that third guy there is different than if you choose to add these two first and then add the third one. So the addition of these generators is not associative. However, there's something that looks almost like the classical addition, and this concerns the addition of irreducible representations. In the following way, suppose, yes.
Presumably, you mean something like n1 hat dot j or something like that, right? Is that what you mean by that?
So j1 I really is a vector, so I really mean j1x, j2y, j2z.
Right, but it's presumably supposed to be the angular momentum around a certain direction, right? And is that how I understand it?
Yes, you can think of this as you have a quantum particle that has some Q and some P. And this is the operator that comes out of it. So okay. It depends on how it's moving and to the initial point, you know, Q with respect to an origin, and then it has some P.
Then by one, do you mean?
For one particle.
I see.
And then I have another particle.
But the angular momentum for two different particles commutes, because the two different particles are different. So how can it be non-associative?
No, because these will refer to indistinguishable particles, but I really should not be doing a course on quantum mechanics. No, I apologize. You're absolutely right. If I say it like this, it's a bit sloppy. You're absolutely correct, but I don't know how to do it in the short time. I have to try. Sorry. So I had been told you guys about quantum mechanics and that all these things were much more understood, but unfortunately, let's stick then to mathematics. If the physical interpretation is more problematic, because there's other concepts that you don't know behind them. So you mentioned out that yes, then let me try to go back to mathematics. I've described those irreducible representations, okay? They're labeled by number J1. Let's consider now two different irreducible representations. The two vector spaces VJ1 and VJ2. J1 and J2 are different. So these are two different vector spaces. One has dimension 2J1 plus 1. The other one has dimension 2J2 plus 1, okay? Now, I can consider a group element, G, belonging to SU2, and I can consider, what do I consider? Yes, here I'm going to have a basis, which is given by J1, M1, and here I have a basis, which is given by J2, M2, okay? Remember, M is what is really labeling the basis. And now I can consider the external product of these two vector spaces, which now I'm sure that nobody has any idea. Imagine here now I take a group element G, and I take its representation. Okay, so its representation as a matrix, so M1, M1 would be in the bracket notation, J1, M1, G, J1, M1, okay, in the bracket notation. And then I have another representation, M2, sorry, J2, M2. N2. Sorry, this was supposed to be N2. Now, when I have, so these are given these two matrices now, I can consider something that might look funny at first, which is the tensor product of matrices, which means that you take the first matrix, the first element, so D11, and you turn this into this number multiplying all the entries of this matrix here. So you turn this into a 2J2 plus 1 times 2J2 plus 1 matrix given by here multiplied by this number here, D11. Okay? If you can do this for all the elements of this matrix here, of the matrix DJ1. So when you do this funny operation that I'm defining is called the tensor product of matrices, and it's typically indicated with a cross surrounded by a circle. So you can imagine that if you do this, you're going to get a mess. You started with your nice, You started with a generic matrix that was representing this SU2 group element in some vector space. You had another one in a different vector space. And now you put all together with this tensor product of matrices. This is now a big matrix whose dimension is the product of the two dimensions of the matrices. And in general, this will not be a reduced, in general, this is still a representation of the group, but is now a reducible representation. Because of some mathematical technicalities that I'm not going to discuss, this is reducible. I told you that reducible means that there's blocks. So D1 here, then there's zeros, then there's another block here, there's zeros of the diagonal, then there's another block here. These blocks can have different dimensions, but that's what reducible means. The fact that this one is reducible means that I can write it precisely that way, with a block here, another block here, and another block here. And the guys that appear in here remind us of the usual property of addition of angular momenta, because what happens is that the guys that appear in here have to satisfy are the following. Let me erase this so that I can just give you. That the guys appearing in there are, you consider the alpha integer G1 and the alpha integer J2, and you consider all the possible alpha integers, which are the sum of the two, minus 1, the sum of the two minus 2, and you go on like this, not until 0. You stop before, you stop when you get to the absolute value of J1 minus J2. So you will go all the way down to 0 only if J1 and J2 are the same. If J1 and J2 are the same, you will stop before 0. And remind that 0 is a trivial representation in which things are, in a sense, there's a single base vector, okay? Because we're going to need it shortly. So in this reducible decomposition, these are the guys that are entering. Here we have J1 plus J2. Here I have J1 plus J2 minus 1. Here I have all big zeros. Here I have all the others until the last one, which is the absolute value of the difference of the two alpha integers. Alpha integers are also commonly named spins. Eh? So these are called spin numbers. And at least I've given you the first hint of why we talk about spin networks, because these objects are going to play now a fundamental role. And now, I imagine you are rather tired. Because I had to do so much detour, I would like to have maybe 5 more minutes. Is that okay if I go on a little bit? Because this took me much more than I thought, because I was expecting you. You know about this stuff. However, you do know about the bracket Dirac's notation, which is going to be very helpful to understand how to write this decomposition. So let me just this we have written it down. I'll do it here so that so what I'm gonna do now is to consider a basis in this big reducible representation, and then to decompose the vectors of this base in terms of the base vectors of these irreducible representations here. Okay? Imagine that you have this huge vector space, and then you realize that in this huge vector space that is all mixed up, you can actually make a local change of basis in such a way that a rotation, an SU2 action, will keep you within that space. Because that's what this means. That these base vectors, J1 and 1 and J2 and 2, they actually, in the tensor product, they decompose in this way, which means that when you act with an SU2 element, the vectors that are in this part of the vector space will stay as linear combination of those base vectors. That's what it means by the value is irreducible. It stays in here. This one will stay in here. This one will stay in here. These zeros will never be touched. Okay. Imagine that one of these is the usual three-dimensional space of vectors. If you act with a rotation on those, you stay in three-dimensional in vectors which are three-dimensional. So that's one. Then you have another one that is also irreducible. So when you act with a rotation, you stay in there. Okay, that's what the interpretation of this irreducible representation should be like in your head. So in order to write down this decomposition, so the base vectors for the big reducible representation, I'm going to use this notation, the same notation as for the matrices. And now I want to know how this decomposes into the base vectors. I want to do local rotations so that I have the usual base vectors for each of these one. So this guy would be J1 plus J2, and then M12, let's call it. The base vector here, a base of vectors here, would be J1 plus J2 minus 1, and then, I don't know, let's call it M12 prime. The dimensionality of N, so the range of variation of N depends on the dimensionality of the representation, as we said. So all the admissible representations are J's such that J is equal to J plus J2, J1 plus J2 minus 1, and so on until J1 minus J2. And then for each one of these, its own M can go from minus J to J. Okay, it's just the notation we have been using so far. So in order to find this decomposition, I'm going to use the fact that these bases here, and so a generic element, I can call it Jm, where J takes all these values, and M accordingly takes the values that it can, okay? So this is a new basis for this tensor product of matrices, and I'm going to show you that this is the basis in which this matrix takes this block diagonal form. Okay, whereas in the original basis of the tensor product of these two, the matrix is in general a messy expression. Okay, and in order to do that, there's going to be some linear coefficients. So this is going to be sum over J and M, where J goes from J1 minus J2 to J1 plus J2, and then sum over M that goes from minus J to J of coefficients, and then these base vectors Jn. And now these coefficients are going to depend on all the variables I have, so they're going to depend on J and M, they're going to depend on J1, J2, M1, and M2. Okay? This is called Clebsch-Jordan decomposition. Clebsch-Jordan, not Flash Gordon, as many physicists spell it, decomposition. And these are called the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. And you might imagine that Clebsch and Gordon are two physicists that work in quantum mechanics. No, they are two mathematicians from the 19th century. So, as I told you, SU2 has to do with classical physics. SU2 was well known and out there way before quantum mechanics was introduced. So, of course, these coefficients now, they can be written. I don't really care for discussing them too much. Last thing, I want to just give you an example which I thought it would have been very familiar, which is the fact that when you have two identical particles, such as two electrons, they can be either in a totally symmetric state, which is called the triplet state, or they can be in a totally antisymmetric state, which is called the singlet state. And this is, of course, from the properties of the spin. then the space wave function accordingly has to be with the opposite parity so that the overall state is completely anti-symmetric. I don't know, this thing I was also giving them for granted, but anyway, let me just write mathematically what it means. In the special case where J1 is equal to J2 is equal to 1/2, and then M1 can take values minus 1/2 and plus 1/2, and the same for M2, then you can write this as 1/2 and 1/2 M1 tensor 1/2 M2. Now, what are the possibly allowed values of J? So the biggest one is the sum of the two, which in this case is 1, which has a dimension 2j plus 1, which is 3. So this is a triplet state, because there's three possible independent states in it. And then the other possibility is, when you go one step down, is j equals 0, which is a singlet state of dimension 1. And so this Clebsch-Gordan decomposition has two terms from the sum, which are when you take j equals 0, in which case m has to be 0 as well, so it's 0, 0, and then 1/2 m1, m2 times 0, 0, plus the second term, when I now take j equals 1, this time I have these sums, m can go from minus 1 to 1, so this is going to be summation for m that goes from minus 1 to 1 of c1m, and then 1/2 m1, m2, and then 1m. And these coefficients are easy to write. I'll write them down explicitly because you're going to need them for one of the exercises, and then we finish for today. This one, you'll notice, is a 2x2 matrix in M1 and M2. And the shape of this matrix is, if I put plus, minus, so when M1 is plus 1/2, that's what I mean, then that coefficient is equal to 1 over square root of 2, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And these guys here are also 2x2 matrices for each choice of M. Okay? So I'm going to give three 2x2 matrices corresponding to the three possible values of M. So M equal 1, and again, plus minus is my choice of basis. Then M equal 0, and then M equal minus 1. And the matrices take the form 1, 0, 0, 0, 1 over square root of 2, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay, so these are the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that tells you how the tensor product of two spin-a-half representations decouple into a singlet representation and a triplet representation. Okay, anything for today? We stop here. Thank you for the patience. And next time we finally try to get back to gravity and see how this enters the game. Oh, of course, if there's any questions, I'm happy to take. Yes?
Still checking the assignments due after the game?
The assignments are due?
When is the due date?
Maybe next Tuesday?
That's our reading week. Is it after
reading? Oh, maybe then, yes.
Yeah.